Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, Jeremy Gavron, the author, will be joining us to discuss his new book, Felix Culper, and explaining why it's been made from lines mostly taken from other writers' work. That's the point, and he's okay with us saying it.
We'll also be discussing the latest issue of Monocle magazine with Chiara Ramella and Josh Fennett, which looks at the best stories from South Korea and beyond.
And as that country's Winter Olympics wrap up this weekend, we'll be learning the story of British ice skating pioneer and gold medalist John Curry. His life and work are the subject of director James Erskine's new documentary, The Ice King.
And Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will also be here with next week's news. And we've got some great music too. That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Tom, wonderful to see your beautiful radio face across the desk.
It's pleasant. I wouldn't rather be having Sunday lunch with my family, Rob.
No, me neither.
I'm happier to be here with you.
I've got the car idling outside. I've got to zoom back, roast a chicken, brown some parsnips, and get all that going. Tom, how about a look ahead at next week's news?
Who knows next week's news today, Rob?
It says on the script Henry Rhys Sheridan. I've never heard of him, but he seems to be someone creeping into the room. Henry, oh Henry.
Hello, both.
Hi, Henry.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
How's it going?
Not bad. So far, it's great. We think it's going okay.
Swimmingly.
But let's see what happens now.
I'm nervous. Today, the closing ceremony for the 2018 Winter Olympics in South Korea is happening. It's going to be a little bit of a diplomatic knees-up. Some important figures are going to be there, including General Kim Jong-chol. Do you know who he is?
Well, I can hazard a guess, Tom.
I'll have a wild stab in the dark.
Go for it.
He is the North Korean military official tasked with, and indeed previously responsible for, strikes against the South. And now he's a guest on their soil.
They're rolling out the red carpet, Rob. What do you think of that?
I kind of feel like, to quote Michael Jackson, let's heal the world, make it a better place for you and for me in the entirety of Korea.
Amen.
I paraphrased Michael there a bit, obviously, but
I think Ivanka Trump's also going to be there. I don't know if they're going to meet each other, but I'm going to enjoy watching it. I do like the opening and closing ceremonies. What's been your favourite sport to watch?
I have to say, punningly slightly, but the Winter Olympics generally leaves me rather cold.
Really?
Yeah.
I prefer it to the Summer Olympics.
No, Rob.
Yes, Rob. I only really like the track and field in the Summer Olympics anyway.
Well, yeah.
So what do you know what I mean?
That's what it's all about.
Yeah. So that's good. But I love the skeleton. I love anything that goes down a kind of tube of ice. I'm up for. That's great. Downhill skiing of all different varieties.
I mean, that is
fast. Super giant slalom, the downhill, those
it's
the proper
fast
sports.
And crazy.
Things like the snowboarding and stuff, that's a load of rubbish. That's not, I mean, you know, it's kind of fine, but it's obviously to get the kids in. I'm fine with that. But I think it's great. I think my favourite is the biathlon, the kind of cross-country skiing, lay down, regulate your heartbeat and try and shoot targets. That's amazing. That's proper stuff, isn't it? I think
apparently it's supposed to be the hardest sport to do.
Is it?
Of any
good
sport.
At?
Yeah. Indeed, yeah. Well, just physically.
Aerobically and in terms of...
destructive of your physical being.
You're not meant to get shot as
no,
part of
you
it.
Want to avoid
Oh, man, that would be good.
Moving on.
Okay.
On the 28th of February, the Camera National Pub of the Year is being, in the words of the news release, crowned. So we should stipulate Camera is the campaign for real ales, isn't it? So they're going to be crowning the National Pub of the Year. I have here a list of 10 points which were enumerated by George Orwell in his last...
The Moon Underwater.
Exactly, his last column for the Evening Standard. He set out his criteria for... the perfect pub. We don't have much time.
Done well here. This is good, isn't it?
This is good stuff.
I hope it's good. Let's see.
Shall I just go through them?
Right,
and then we can discuss after. Number one, the architecture and fittings must be uncompromisingly Victorian. Two, games such as darts are only played in the public bar so that in other bars you can walk around without the worry of flying darts. The pub is quiet enough to talk, with the house possessing neither a radio nor a piano, less of a concern nowadays. The barmaids know the customers by name and take an interest in everyone, again, of its time, but it sells tobacco and cigarettes, aspirins and stamps.
And that's basically the Victorian, that's the sort of 1930s free Wi-Fi.
Indeed. And well, I think this might be the closer analogy, and is obliging about letting you use the telephone.
Yeah.
Number six, there is a snack counter where you can get liver sausage sandwiches, mussels, cheese, pickles, and large biscuits with caraway seeds.
Wow, I love him. Even more than I thought I did.
That is specific.
Number seven, upstairs, 6 days a week, you can get a good solid lunch. For example, a cut off the joint, two vegetables, and boiled jam roll for about £3.
Yeah.
Number eight, a creamy sort of draft stout is served, and it goes better in a pewter pot. Number nine,
he's right.
They are particular about their drinking vessels at the Moon Underwater and never, for example, make the mistake of serving a pint of beer in a handleless glass. Apart from glass and pewter mugs, they have one of those pleasant strawberry pink china ones. But in my opinion, beer tastes better out of china.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Number 10, finally, you go through a narrow passage leading out of the salon and find yourself in a fairly large garden.
Yeah.
Many, as are the virtues of the Moon Underwater, I think that the garden is its best feature because it allows whole families to go there instead of mum having to stay at home and mind the baby while dad goes out alone.
That is fabulous.
It's a good list, isn't it? Yeah.
Really good list. Really good list.
Well done,
I love
George
his specificity
Orwell.
Of bar snacks.
Yeah.
Liver sandwiches.
Yeah, no.
Pretty good. Pretty hard.
Was there a better describer of the peculiarities of the British human condition?
I don't think so. Don't.
The Norwell.
Neither before nor since.
I don't think so. And very finally, guys, I'm going to hand the mic over to you to talk a little bit about the Monocle Media Summit, which is happening tomorrow here in Marylebone.
You're limbering up already, aren't you, Rob? You're doing your breathing exercises.
I'm gargling with TCP. I'm doing some sit-ups. I've got my medicine ball, and I'm tossing it from here to John Batsek, who I'm going to be interviewing about the golden age, what we're calling the golden age of documentary. He's a preeminent documentary producer, produced amazing films such as Searching for Sugar Man, The Final Year, which is in cinemas now, which is about Obama's final year in administration, and various classics. We're going to be kind of touching on all points of media. Print, obviously, we have deep interest in that. We're going to be speaking to the writer, an originator of Deutschland 83, which became Deutschland 86. We're going to see what's happening with that. So it's all sorts of stuff. It's going to be good stuff. Let's high-five the Monocle Media Summit then give you, Henry, a big, munificent hug for top-class news look ahead, don't you think, Tom?
Absolutely. What was it? Liver sandwiches. They're on me. British author Jeremy Gavron has garnered critical acclaim with books that take an unconventional approach to narrative. They include A Woman on the Edge of Time, a memoir built around the suicide of his mother, the writer Hannah Gavron, and The Book of Israel, which looked at Jewish culture through the lens of family life.
His latest is a work of fiction that's perhaps his boldest experiment yet. Felix Culper is a mystery involving a writer investigating the life and death of a young man. But the text is made almost entirely from already published classics, ranging from Oliver Twist to The Road. 100 books from over 80 writers inform the narrative. Jeremy Gavron joins us now. Welcome to the programme. Thank you very much for coming in.
It's good to be here.
What a startling idea for a novel, Jeremy. Tell us the kind of line that you ended up taking for a walk, the line from a novel that kind of started it all.
Well, other than following a route of sheer lunacy.
Yeah. We'll come to that later. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I've, from sort of quite an early stage writing fiction, I've been interested in how form as well as content can reflect the our ever-changing world. So I'm sort of open to form breaking up and fracturing and going to new places. And when I sat down to start writing this novel quite a few years ago now, I couldn't make it work in a more conventional way, and it began to break up. And then sort of out of nowhere, lines from other books began to appear in the narrative that I was typing. And I just sort of followed that trail.
so it might be a regular thing for most novelists to admire just maybe a line of another novelist's prose and kind of build an idea, structure a shell around that. But you kind of took that to the nth degree, basically.
I think novelists are rather coy about their influences. Yeah. I'm not sure they own up enough to it. So it was part of the fun of doing very openly what everybody does more surreptitiously, and not only doing it openly, but celebrating it.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, because as you read the book, you're constantly thinking, now, were there a selection of lines that you gathered as you read each of the novels? I imagined a huge room with a sort of, like sort of red rum, red rum, red rum. These thousands of post-it notes that you'd added. What was the actual technical process?
Like one of these,
if you can give that away.
These sort of film crazies like Kerry and Homeland, with sort of making huge things on their wall. Initially, the lines were lines that were in my head. And then they started to be lines that I could half remember, so I would go and look them up. And then I would look them up, and then I would start flicking through the pages thinking, well, that might work, and that might work. And then eventually I did it in a more systematic way, going through books with a particular kind of book. They were really mostly my favourite books, the books that had shaped me as a writer, with a red pen, and then storing those lines. It never went up on the wall.
Oh, okay.
As a kind of missing persons crime scene thing, reenactment.
Well, anyway, that's my story.
Yeah, exactly. Let's not go into Jeremy's attic. That is an interesting thing. As you said, there is certain honesty about the novel and the project, the idea behind it, to make a string of connections between the favourite or the most poignant lines, perhaps, in your favourite books. What about your relationship with those books now that you've kind of used them as source material, not just as sort of subconscious source material, as you might have done all your writing life, but as very conscious source material? Do you have a different relationship with those novels?
Yes, well, certainly at the time I did. And I realised how exciting it was to read great works of literature, but also my favourite works in a more active way. You know, when you read, obviously reading is you engage with a text, you're involved with it, and that's the kind of writing that I do, I try and get the readers to engage more. But it's still effectively quite a passive. You sit and you read. Whereas this, I was reading, I was wanting to borrow lines, I was looking for lines. It was like a conversation with these books. And I found that really exciting and great fun to do that. So I think I sort of felt that I got under the skin of books as a reader in a different way.
Yeah, and I guess you're trying to find different, you're trying to find sort of propulsive sections of novels as much as sort of the more poetic, descriptive passages of novels. Well, you kind of have to sort of chop and change and kind of think, hang on, we need to get the action going here. I noticed you've got almost all of Raymond Chandler's novels in your index. I mean, which are very good for moving the action on, right?
Yes, when you're writing a detective novel, it helps to have exactly some of the sort of more technical elements that he brings it. A lot of the lines actually from Chandler are also quite poetic. So I was looking for both. By the time I started writing the novel in this way, and I had a pretty good idea of what the story was, so there were times when I was just collecting lines that would fit within my story. There were times when I would come across a line that suggested something new. So that was also, you know, kind of active part of the reading process. So part of this novel is partly made out of other books, but it's also created by the inspiration of those other books.
And to that point about active and passive reading, what about your readers? Did you sort of anticipate what their engagement with the book would be? Because it is interesting, and reading these pages, I became aware quite acutely of how often I sort of allowed my eye to sort of scan ahead through a paragraph, which is, I guess, a bit lazy and probably to a novelist is like anathema. But it's sort of harder to do. You kind of you're compelled because of the structure to digest every individual line. Was that sort of a conscious desire on your part? Or?
Yeah, I love books that have lots of white space in them. I love books that break up, that fragment. To me, the perfectly formed narrative, sort of beautiful sentences flowing into beautiful paragraphs, flowing into beautiful chapters and novels. Does that represent the modern world we live in? I mean, that's, you know, that's the way Jane Austen wrote. The world has changed quite a lot since Jane Austen wrote. We live live a much more fragmented existence. So partly I really like books that fragment. But also that white space, as you say, it leaves space for the reader. Because a lot of the lines in this book are so short, I think you have to read it to some degree like you read poetry. You have to slow down. It insists, as it obviously did for you, it insists that you slow down. I mean, we're talking about that there are going to be any readers. Let's hope so.
Yeah, but it is. We found that when we were reading it, and not only kind of vaguely trying to spot the novel, or at least the novelist by the line and all the rest of it, but yeah, that idea that each line has to be kind of absorbed. Each line is almost a paragraph, isn't it?
Yes,
in a sense.
Yes, yes,
so I suppose you've kind of got that idea. What are we're looking at the back? As I said, there's lots of Raymond Chandler. There's The Drowned World you've used by J.G. Ballard. There are all these sorts of things. I mean, what does the cutting room floor look like? I wonder, because I presume a novelist such as yourself has a pretty healthy library. Were there novels that you kind of wanted to go to because you knew that there could be expositionary paragraphs and sentences in that you don't necessarily love, just so that you could kind of move the action on? And then again, fairly impenetrable novels that have moments of great poetry in, I wonder.
It was more of an organic process. I think I realised at some point that how much this story had grown out of books that I particularly loved and read, and books that I keep on certain shelves near my desk that I go back to frequently. Mm. They're sort of books of a certain type about outcasts, about journeys, about mysteries and adventures. And so I think it was really more just a question of going back to those particular shelves in my study where I work. And it was more just books I loved, books that drew me. There was a certain degree. Occasionally, I would read about a book, and I'd think, "Oh, that might work."
So yeah,
I would bring that
so
into
reading
the
reviews or something.
Yeah,
something
like that. But I'd say 2/3 of the books, certainly 3/4 probably, were books I'd read before I did the project, and 2/3 of them were sort of old favourites.
And it really struck me when you said earlier, "Oh, they were lines that were just in my head anyway." Is that so? Full sentences. Not rote learned, of course, but I just wonder, to get that an insight from a writer such as yourself, do you just remember verbatim sentences of books? Because my very limited brain just gets these sort of broad brush impressions. I don't think I could recall to that level of detail. But
well, it's my life working with fiction, so. And I teach it as well. Yeah, I do have quite a lot of lines. You can talk to my daughters. They'll tell you how much I bore them by quoting lines at them. I mean, I remember vividly the first line that actually came out right at the beginning of the novel. The writer who's the central character in the novel, one of the two central characters, goes to work in a prison. And it was something that I'd done myself. I spent 2 years working in a prison. I was trying to catch the idea of what it was like to wander the wings as I had done, talking to the men, hearing their stories. And these were men whose lives had sort of fallen apart, who'd fallen through the cracks of society. And this line from The Great Gatsby, "privy to the secret griefs of wild unknown men," just sort of came out of my fingers as I was typing. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, that really works. I like that. And I like the fact that I'm borrowing that line. So that was the sort of initial impetus.
That's on page 2, just in case.
Yeah,
I was intrigued when I read some of the notes that came with the novel, Jeremy, about that you wandering the wings of prisons should remind you of Gatsby, which we, the most glitzy kind of life in fiction almost, and then it reminded you of that. I kind of thought that was an amazing thing, because there are presumably lines from novels that are, I don't know whether there's Solzhenitsyn in there, but there are things that are deeply unglamorous and about servitude and about war and about, all the evils in the world that you can also take out of context and use as something potentially quite beautiful and bright. There is something interesting and strange in that. Conceit of the novelist, isn't it?
Yes, and I think that's an essential part of the novel and why, I would argue very strongly that there's nothing plagiaristic about it, because each line is taken and used anew and something new is made out of it. So often lines are used in very different contexts from the original lines. Not always, but often they are. I mean, there are lines that are from books...
I just want to use something from that, from Solzhenitsyn, as a punchline to a joke. I'd love to see that done. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Project
possible.
Project 2.
I mean, Solzhenitsyn isn't actually in there, but Varlam Shalimov is, who writes about gulags.
Yeah,
And I think, I'm sure there's a line or two in his that are from very different contexts. And also there are lines in there that are about animals that I use about people, and lines that are about people that I use about animals. So it was one of the pleasures of doing it, was to take lines and rework them in a different way.
Are there some who are still with us?
Yeah, quite a few.
Quite a few. Have you had any exchanges with any of them?
No.
Do you anticipate that? No, I just wonder, because it's an amazing thing you said there. There's a sort of tribute element to it, but there's also something completely innovative. And I just think it would be so interesting to have you and they sit down in a conversation about it.
Well, I've only used one friend's. A book of poetry by a friend is the only one. So it's the only one, somebody who I know well, he took it as a tribute very happily. I would hope that that's how people do. Mm. That's what people, the people's attitude is. But I'm, you know, I'm be interested if anyone complained.
What about the voice? Because there is a sort of singular voice, which is an amazing feat to get that. The tone switches around necessarily because it's a book with a plot and things happen, so that changes. But the voice is quite singular. That must have been a very difficult thing to get right and to get it honed to your satisfaction.
That was one of the big challenges. How do you write a book that's made out of mostly out of lines from 80 or from 100 other books to feel like a single book? And a lot of it, I think, was to do with music and rhythm of the language. I've always loved music and rhythm of language. It's always been central to my writing. But I had to think about it even more so here. And a lot of it was, I would do things like I would cut the pronouns off the front of sentences so that the beat is often, if you look at it, the beat is often on the first word of each line. And that helps. So if you're thinking about, certainly when you're reading it aloud, but also when you read it in your head, if the beat is falling in the same place, that gives a unity to the prose.
Does that help with the meaning of it? Is that something that simply propels the reader when the reader is perhaps unused to reading something like this, where it is, as I said, it's almost a thought, a paragraph is a line? Is that to give each line that extra force?
I think the beat, if you look at poetry, the beat often falls on the key words, in a line. And so if the rhythmic beat directs your attention to the most important word in a line, helps you to digest it.
Well, we were trying to think earlier, playfully, of could this have a new terminology to describe the kind of novel this is? Because I was saying it's almost sort of like pontilistic or something. There's this sort of pizzicato. Is it a frustration to you? I guess it was inevitable that people would sort of say to you, they'd ask you about, is it genre defining or defying? Is it a new thing?
Or defiant.
Defiant. Does that matter to you?
I mean, I'm certainly interested in books that do challenge genre, so I'm happy to be sort of mixed in with them. But there is actually a type of poem called a cento or cento, which is made up entirely of lines from other poems. So poetry has a model, but they're usually about 10 lines long or 15
You've
lines
slightly
long.
Pushed it.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And just to finish, I liked something that you said at the beginning of our conversation, Jeremy, about... You said, you know, you'll find that novelists are surprisingly coy about their sort of source material some of the time. Is this the regular way for most of your books and in your experience, you know, other writers that you know, that you talk to, that, you know, that are under the same, that with the same publisher as you, that a lot of writers take a line for a walk? You know, they kind of love some minor detail in some other novel and expand on it. Because the world is, it's full of infinite ideas, but a lot of the time, if you're a person in a room with a word processor, the world is also full of finite ideas. How common is that?
I think that's very common, and more. I think writers are borrowing and stealing and pilfering and in all sorts of ways from each other. And I think in artists are much more open about it. Mm. Visual artists, you know, Picasso said art is theft.
Yeah.
Poets are more open about it. T.S. Eliot said mature poets steal. But novelists are much more coy.
Not this one.
In different ways. Yes.
Sorry, we just had a really good chat about this great book, and I've just ruined it in the last stanza. Thank you, Jeremy. And Felix Culpa by Jeremy Gavron is out now, and you are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. Let's hear some music now. This is new from the Baltimore duo Beach House with Lemon Glow.
Sounds of Beach House there with Lemon Glow. This is the Monocle Weekly.
The new edition of Monocle is on shelves now. It's a bumper issue with a special focus on the best ideas coming out of South Korea for 2018. We'll be discussing the country's recent soft power showcase at the Winter Olympics at the end of the show. But before that, we're joined by Monocle's Chiara Ramella and Josh Fennett to talk us through a few other highlights.
Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming to see us on the Monocle Weekly this Sunday lunchtime.
So the March issue of Monocle has got a Korean focus. It's called the Fast Track Nation. Josh, it's an epic cover. It pops off the newsstand. One would hope it will be anyway. It looks like good stuff. Talk us to a couple of stories on the cover, if you'd be so kind.
So it's an interesting question, Rob, and I think you would agree that there's a consensus on the editorial floor that great things are happening in Korea. There's been a cleanup of the government, a cutting of red tape, a boom in the culture industry, your very beat in K-pop, in...
Amazing art galleries there as well, and interesting art collectors, in fact, one of which James Chambers, our Hong Kong editor, profiles in this magazine. I mean, it probably is one of those things you can kind of blow smoke up a country's posterior, but you have a palpable sense of kind of like of something happening, of something kind of discovery, I think, when you go there.
And, you know, we interviewed the president, Moon Jae-in, who's in an unenviable position of coming in to a system with a lot of red tape. He has to deal with the interests of a noisy neighbour, shall we say, with Donald Trump in the US, and balancing all of these extremely delicate issues around the country. But the culture section is thriving. The design scene is thriving. There's not a spot in Soho that isn't being eyed up by a Korean restaurant. So the soft power of the food scene is booming and bubbling as well. And actually, an interesting fact for you, soju, the Korean rice wine, is the most drunk liquor in the world. Did you know that?
Wow. No, I didn't know that. That's incredible, really. The most drunk liquor.
When you talk about made in Britain, and we talk about this sort of confusion about what that is, and we're uncertain about where that's going post-Brexit and all that, I guess made in Korea is a much more sort of resonant notion. And actually, it spans everything from cutting edge, you know, huge electronics companies, R&D, innovation, but also this mastery of these softer cultural exports as well. It seems to know what it means when it talks about what Made in Korea represents.
And I think that's a drastic shift. If you think about Made in Korea, like Made in Taiwan 15 years ago, that was not a mark of quality. Today, with Hyundai, with Samsung, with these amazing kind of multinational, completely global, players that are influencing everything from the shape of our TVs to the technology we carry around in our pockets. There's quite a lot going in big industry. There's a tremendous amount of artisanal, interesting design studios pushing the envelope as well. So it was just our feeling at the moment during the Winter Olympics, particularly where there's a bit of a showcase of the beauty of the nation as well, that we could go in there, we could find some positive stories, and we could spin some yarns that people hadn't heard before about the nation, which hopefully people could take back and put some positive lessons to use in their own cities.
Kiara, I'm going to start with you. There's more to pencils than anyone thought, as your excellent piece, headlined Right on Time, testifies.
Yes, I think we should begin that by saying that, in your honour, this piece about the industry of the pencil should have really borne another headline, and that headline should have been To Be or Not To Be.
That was my suggestion. Playful.
But alas.
Such a good headline.
Mixed. Erased, if you want. But tell us, why did we zero in, laser focus on pencils? Because if we are to believe the hype that seems to be prevalent, no one's going to use any writing implements and we'll all just be using screens.
Well, that's what they would have you believe. And in fairness, if you think about how many of the, what percentage of the words that you write every day you write with a pencil, you'll probably be inclined to believe that pencils aren't doing very well. But not so. Because actually, by a coincidence of different factors, we have found out after my long, lengthy investigation into the matter, due to a series of different factors that have got to do with growth of population in emerging markets, such as China, India, and their efforts into educating more of their population, as well as a growth in the population of the older generation in markets that are already kind of developed, plus a general sense of discontent with the screen and its tyranny. All of these combined basically mean that the pencil's having quite a good time. In fact, 2016 was the year that the strongest year on record, because, admittedly, of the weird trend in colouring books for adults.
Of course.
I'll let you discuss how you feel about that.
Yeah.
The fact that it saved the industry, but also was a boom in colouring books for adults.
A deeply infantilising concept. What do you think? What do we all think about that?
True, but does not the end justify the means, in a manner of speaking?
I.e.,
as long as there's more pencils.
Yeah, okay, then the world's better.
How many
place
are we talking?
What about
in the many billions?
Yeah, in the region of the billions.
Wow.
Well, this company that I went to see, Fila in Italy, obviously, makes about $3 billion a year themselves alone. So we're talking big numbers.
And do they? Do you talk? I'm sure you do talk in beautiful detail, Chiara, about the tactile satisfactions of the pencil. About you think differently with a pencil in your hand than you do with your fingers poised over a laptop keyboard, presumably. I mean, we all work with both in the office, don't we, every day? But I know my mind works differently depending upon what I'm doing, I suppose. What about this? Do Fila attribute some of their success to a kind of bit of a return to wanting to kind of have those thoughts that you had when you were a kid, or kind of being able to see the fibre, the fruit of your labours immediately?
For sure. I mean, there's something really interesting that Mark Cass of Cass Art, the retailer of art supplies here in London, said to me, which is that the pencil remains still the most immediate way of making a mark. Mm. And I think that's something about the directness of the act that is the unmediated kind of tactile act of like he talks about it and basically makes a comparison with a caveman's act. Like, he really does say that it's something quite primitive.
Speaking of early man and his crude scratchings dragged into the filth with a stick, Josh Fenner, are you an enthusiastic advocate of the humble pencil?
I am indeed. I'm more wondering how Chiara was holding her pencil to draw that kind of comment from the head of Cass Art, comparing you to a Neolithic man daubing something on the side of a cave. But yes, I'm going to take you to the more delicious pages. At the back of the magazine, we do talk to the South Korean president. We do augur the future for a country having a high moment. But I just wanted to pick out three little stories which I think bring glad tidings for things that we at Monocle hold dearly. The first one is the opening of a massive new food shop called the Grand Epicerie. There was previously one on the Left Bank, which is owned by the Bon Marché, which is owned by LVMH. But this new space in Passy, in Paris, just north of the river, is an utter celebration of excess, of having too much, of having beautiful basketfuls of amazing products shipped around the world and available for you to just stuff your tote with.
Physical
retail at its finest. You've got the page open.
Page open here, Josh. It's a beautiful story, I have to say. I mean, we've got some some lovely pictures on spread here of just the way that they sort of stack the shelves. Sort of beautiful, old-fashioned packaging, bottles in glass, beautiful kind of multicoloured cans of all sorts of gear. Looks like they're kind of like the world's kind of excess jam mountain there, in a good way. I mean, just amazing stuff.
And there's no question, is there, that is going to make you buy more and more often than buying it through a little tiny screen or whatever. Forget about the convenience. That has more allure, and it always will have.
So there's two or three great things going on here. One is that if you show off amazing products, and let's face it, they cost a little more. These hand plucked fish from a stream or whatever, they cost a little bit more. But if they're shown off in this beautiful place, it's a real positive space for physical retail. It's a boon to smaller producers, and it shows that big brands like LVMH still think that you want to go into a shop and be given some advice and be spoken to and be shaken by the hand and leave with a nice tote bearing the name of somewhere that you're proud to have been. Kind of the opposite of the dystopian Amazon supermarket where you walk out and the money disappears from your card and no one makes eye contact. And I just want to pick up on another story in the more delicious pages at the back of the magazine as well. We've got two great new openings here in London, both in London's Soho. One, to link back to your chat with another Neolithic man that's graced the show's lineup today, Henry Rhys Sheridan. It's a beautiful revival of a pub called the Blue Posts on Rupert Street in Soho. It goes back to 1739, and two wonderful restaurateurs, previously owners of The End, which was a very famous nightclub, have opted for a rather slower life in recent years and opened a number of beautiful restaurants. The Barbary, Palomar, and a new coffee shop as well. But what they've done is they've said, pubs, there's a big problem with their disappearance in London. Where can you go for a watering hole that's democratic, that's nice, where you can sit, where you can relax, maybe have a game of darts and a few caraway seeds? What they've said is the pub isn't dead, just the way people do it is dead. And, in order to invest in this old place and bring it back to life, they've put a beautiful restaurant downstairs, a cocktail bar upstairs, but they've kept it looking like a pub. You've got to open here, Rob. Is this somewhere you'd sink a cider?
Absolutely. It's very tempting, isn't it? I think let's all sod the family lunches today and just make for the Blue Posts. So in terms of the vibe, I mean, are we kind of talking, do we kind of need to tuck our shirts in? I can see that this won't be any, Tom won't be able to wear his Arsenal shirt.
Whoa. Rob, come on now.
Or whatever the team, his Spurs shirt in there. No work wear and no football regalia, I'd have thought, in there. But does it feel pubby to you, Josh? Does it have some of the qualities that Henry was talking about in George Orwell's proscriptions for the best pub in the world?
Yeah, totally it does. And when I was being shown around by the owner, a guy called Leo Paskin, who's, as I said, run an amazing nightclub for 13 years that, you know, had Fatboy Slim before he won any awards or released any albums, that, you know, launched these amazing musical acts. If he knows anything, it's how to put on a bit of a night. And so all of the little design details that have gone into it, they bought antique glass for all of the booths so the candlelight shimmers off them. And, you know, they do have craft beers, which has become a rather wanky term, but they're just good ones. They're not in there because some guy made it in his garage. They're in there because they're absolutely delicious. And that sense of democracy, that sense of everyone sitting next to each other, it really comes through in it. And like you said, you know, it's a tough market for pubs to survive in. You've got to have the punters in. You can't be too snooty and elitist. You can't be ushering people out the back because Tom's wearing his Arsenal top.
He really hates that.
It's, by the way, your page is looking absolutely amazing. They're looking epic at the moment. Really, so many good stuff. Everything is making me put on pounds and stagger, totter from pillar to post just by looking at the pictures, Josh. I have to say, it's great stuff.
Am I allowed to give you one more story to mull over, which links nicely to the Blue Post? Because we often talk about new restaurants, we often talk about these great destinations which you need to get to, queue around the block, you know, book a month in advance. But there's another property, Kettner's Townhouse in Soho. Now, does that ring any bells?
Is that in here as well?
Yeah, it is. It's in the inventory section at the back. It's the third of three new hotels that we profile. Kettner's Townhouse is a beautiful old property from the 1860s, so equally it's old, but recently revamped and done up by the Soho House Group. So in this and the Blue Post, there's two kind of veterans that have been around for 10, 15 years, turning good places into great places. And I just think this is a nice note on the hospitality industry. You don't have to be, you know, a young guy in a railway arch, you know, doing a pop-up. You can build proper, good old-fashioned, hearty, you know, beautiful restaurants that look like they did 100 years ago. And I think that shows great hope for the London scene as well, that we're not too distracted by novelty. You know, we love a listed Art Deco mirror. We love a bit of silver service now and again.
I do love the look of this place. This is kind of fin de siècle kind of old school stuff, isn't it? I love the sort of brass drinks trolley and stuff. It's really beautiful. Do you think we might have run out of time? Do you think we might have to kiss our beautiful fellow editors goodbye, Tom?
After you, Rob.
Kiara and Josh, thank you very much for joining us. What should we say? This Korean special of Monocle is in all good newsagents now. The Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang closes today, and what a 2 weeks it's been. The drama's been unfolding both on and off screen, with everything from a doping scandal enveloping the unlikely sport of curling, to the US skater Adam Rippon feuding with US Vice President Mike Pence over issues concerning his sexuality.
But drama and sport do indeed go hand in hand, and our final guest on the show today is James Erskine, director of a new film uniting both. The Ice King looks at the life of British figure skater John Curry, an Olympic gold medalist himself. Back in 1976, he had to weather the media's reaction over being a gay athlete during an era when attitudes were unfortunately less open than today. James Erskine joins us now to discuss it, but first, let's hear a clip from the film.
He was different. His positions and body lines were superb.
Beautiful arms, a great back, and the head up.
He was physically the perfect male specimen.
The best skater in the world, and his name is John Curry.
Difference is something that is looked down upon with shame and loathing. I think John had a very difficult childhood, and skating became the escape. All he had were his skates and his talent. And now John was going into the Olympics.
He was very determined. I'm going to skate and I'm going to win.
I remember standing there at the Olympics and just watching this moment of perfection happen.
It was just so different to anyone else.
Can you imagine what it would be like having won a gold medal and then to go to a press conference where the major thing of interest is to whether or not he was gay?
Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, James. Very good to have you with us. Tell us a bit about John Curry, because I guess we'll probably have listeners who'll remember him and the impact he made actually on the sport and I guess culture more broadly then. But maybe tell us what your sort of recollections of him and his influence were before we talk about the project itself.
Yeah, I don't know really what my recollections were before coming to this project. I mean, I came into it because I read a piece which was in the Guardian newspaper written by Bill Jones, who'd written a very well-respected biography, and I bought the rights to that biography of John Curry and explored its story. But what stood out to me about John Curry, what I think is why this film is important and to a degree timeless, is that he's unique. You know, nobody at the Winter Olympics this year at the Summer Olympics playing Premier League soccer is attempting to do anything other than be a great athlete. What John Curry was doing uniquely was attempting to be a great athlete and a great artist. And that's what's so spectacular. And he succeeded at both. I mean, he got a gold medal and he got to perform at, you know, the two most important performance venues in the world, the Met Opera House and the Royal Albert Hall, you know, as an artist, just as Nureyev would dance there, you know, which is what his dream was. His dream wasn't even to win a gold medal. And it's extraordinary. And then, of course, he has this fascinating biography, you know, and the sort of headline of being the first gay Olympian, which he was, I mean, probably the first, certainly the first gay, openly gay gold medal winner, possibly the first openly gay prominent athlete anywhere in the world. And, you know, very dramatically told, he won the gold medal and he was a national hero. This is ice skating, which is the jewel in the crown of the Winter Olympics, televised around the world. He was completely compelled and by this incredible performance he did to Don Quixote. And then literally the next day, you know, the headlines are the haunted hero goes from golden boy to haunted hero. And his sexuality becomes the story. And that, you know, in a way, that moment sort of encapsulates his life, that he was struggling to be himself and to be accepted for his sexuality as many other people were. And every time he made a major achievement, that was thrown into conflict and thrown back at him. So I think, you know, it's an incredible story of somebody who's an anti-hero, really, but has a heroic trajectory that, you know, to their big up their obstacle to become the great artist they want to be is to win a gold medal. I mean, that's crazy. Yeah. And their obstacle to be themselves is to be allowed to be themselves is the rest of the world. You know, I mean, that's quite a lot to overcome. The media, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The damn media.
So you've got some fascinating tensions set up right there. And in the introduction, you've got the sort of the sober idea of sport. And if you're a man, the kind of manliness of that as well. Then you've got the idea of artistry thrown into this. Figure skating is such an unusual sport in that sense that, you know, they call Federer a poet on centre court, etc. But there is not art, you're not awarded extra points for your artistry as you are in figure skating, the style with which you pull off the tricks. And then you've got the sexuality. I feel that there might be a wall covered in post-it notes in your editing suite, James, of how to play these tensions off against each other. Or did the biography that you bought the rights to and the life of John Curry itself kind of just lend itself to a natural sort of stream of storytelling?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't quite sure when I bought it and was thinking about it, and actually even I raised the budget, actually how I was going to tell this story. So it wasn't sort of there as a roadmap, but there are these obvious flashpoints like the Olympic moment and the outing. You know, his greatest performance, certainly from prestige point of view, was playing at the Met Opera House in New York to packed houses, unprecedented, you know, and never repeated since. You know, no one's ever put ice there before. It was the show sold out faster than anything else in the history of the Met Opera House. You know, of course, it went slightly wrong when the ice didn't freeze and they lost a day's performance. And it was a disaster from a business point of view, which is also the John Curry story. You know, the vision was bigger than it was possible to achieve. And I think so there are these great flashpoints. Obviously, that was, you know, 1984. And that was when, you know, people were really starting to understand AIDS for the first time and the devastation it was causing. And that was obviously a big devastation in his personal life. So you have these sort of two classic tension moments, really. You know, at the Olympics, I win the gold medal, but I'm outed. My mother now knows I'm gay. To, you know, 1984 to, you know, I'm playing on the greatest stage of all, but the company's going to the wall and my personal life is looking pretty bad. My lovers and friends are dying, and maybe I am too. I don't know the exact timing of when he discovered he had HIV. So you had this tension. But what I wanted to do within the story was within this film was to always make it about the performance and put John's expression. You know, John, I sort of toyed a lot with, like, was this a political film and was he a political figure? And, you know, this idea that, which actually, you know, is interesting with sort of athletes and artists about how they project themselves and the dialogue they're having with the world. You know, you could be an important civil rights figure without being Martin Luther King. You don't only have to speak in words, and not everybody can speak in words. And actually, so Curry's way of speaking to the world was to say, this is who I am, watch me completely, be completely compelled with me and fall in love with what I do, you know, and then ask yourself whether you really hate me in the way that you think you do.
But that came after he was outed. He was able to kind of use that for to his advantage.
I think he was already doing that. I think that's actually the challenge that he faced in the skating world, was he just said, I'm going to do it this way. This is how I want to be. This is who I'm going to be. And if you don't like it, you know, hey. To cut a long story short, you know, his performance were the essence of him. They were essence of what he was trying to say about himself biographically, you know, and you can see that in the film very clearly. And the music he chooses is very, he chooses the music thinking about the story that he wants to tell to that audience. You know, Don Quixote, when he wins the Olympic performance, you know, of course, Don Quixote is a man who tilts at windmills. He's not choosing this by accident because he likes that bit of music, you know. When he, there's other pieces you can see very clearly that he chooses that have this great history and this storied history. So I wanted to put those performances at the centre. And then what I did was actually structure the film. We actually wrote a big list on a big whiteboard in the office, and we wrote down sort of 12 dancers that we wanted, or performances that we wanted to include, and what the music was and what it was going to say about him, and then structured the biography so that the music was the way into each effective chapter in the film, but almost the performance was the way out. So actually we used a lot of sort of, I'm not going to call them cliffhangers because they are, a lot of points where we took the telling of his story so far, like where we talk about him being beaten up, you know, we never actually say what actually happened. We just refer to this, became a national headline that John Curry was beaten up. Now, we as the audience know at this point is because he's interested in, you know, going to violence X clubs and stuff, and that there may be some allusion to that. But we don't need to say that, because actually what happens is his story jumps along and he goes into the performance and the scene changes. And that was key. It was like, it doesn't matter that, you know, it was to say, look, these things are going on and they're happening simultaneously, you know. This didn't, because he got beaten up, didn't mean it all went wrong for him. It meant he had to restart again. You know,
it's interesting. There's almost a sort of choreography of the filmmaking that mirrors the choreography on the ice, which is interesting. On that point you made about how political or not the piece is, it's interesting. Obviously, you've looked at sport before in documentary very successfully with the Battle of the Sexes, things like that. Is it harder for sportsmen and women themselves to achieve the kinds of challenges that Curry attempted to meet and did meet indeed? Is it harder to do? Are they so sort of surrounded by advisors, and it's such a media circus, and the money is so huge? I mean, Rob in the intro mentions, you know, Adam Rippon, the US ice skater, who's sort of, this has kind of come up in the Winter Olympics this time round, but it seems to happen less and less. But then I suppose the counterpoint to that is, you see, say, the American footballers with the taking a knee, and there still seems to be a power in sport. Is, I don't know, will we get a story like this again with the same kind of political ramifications, do you think?
Will we get a story? I'm sure we'll get a story again. I think that the challenges are, I think, you know, you could talk about money and big sponsors in the sport that make those things difficult, and that's why, you know, Colin Kaepernick, you know, was really brave in standing up that in a world where it's really money. John Curry's world was not full of money in that way, you know, and so other athletes and supreme athletes, sponsors don't want people to be controversial, you know, at all. So that's a challenge for athletes. And I also think that the thing to remember about athletes is, by and large, you know, you get to be a great athlete by practicing a lot and spending your entire life devoted to a single activity. And by and large, you achieve success at a really young age where you have not necessarily developed your political views. And so I think it's rare to find athletes that have actually thought about the world in that way and approach. I think there are some big figures. I mean, there's Jim Brown in America, who is, you know, a very important American footballer, who was right there with Muhammad Ali in that time when it was very edgy. But of course, if you're coming into a world where there's already a civil rights movement, an athlete can stand next to Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, you know, it's harder if the movement's not clear. I mean, even with Billie Jean King, she's standing next to Gloria Steinem. You know, this movement is going on at the same time, and the athlete is able to bring that conversation to a wider audience. And Billie Jean King's very interesting. She's, you know, she talks about, you know, using the body, and that being a different form of feminism, and feminism being driven by only the head and not the body. And actually, but most women, just as most men, are not. It's not their brains that drive them through life. It's their emotions and their physical being and the simplicity. And so will there be other people? Yeah, there will be, but I don't know. Maybe they won't be quite in the same in European, Western European culture. Maybe we'll see it more in other more repressive cultures. And maybe the things that will really change will be questions like, you know, the deeper questions of race. Like it will be, you know, when an African team wins the Football World Cup, when actually the sporting hegemony changes, when an Indian player, an Indian or a Pakistani woman wins Wimbledon. You know, those are the, to me, are where those big sporting stories seem that they're going to come, because that's just seems the point where repression needs to be fought.
What a documentary! What a documentary that would be, right?
Yeah, right.
Get your name down first, yeah.
You've obviously got some great source material to work on here with John Curry's routines. Figure skating looks great on screen, and you obviously want to be sort of fairly sparing with the source material, as well as kind of, you know, seeing things more than once, I suppose, as well. How did you corral that? How do you use that in the film?
Yeah, I mean, actually, there was a point when I was doubting whether we should make the film, even though we had the money, because I was like, I just don't know what's the bit that's missing, and what if there's these great performances that supposedly were never filmed, and if we had them, and I said it as a challenge to Shuan and Luke, who were working with me, and I was like, just find me those. If you find me those performances, we'll make the film. If not, I'm done with this. It's just going to be too difficult. And that's when we turned up a couple of the most remarkable performers. I mean, the single most remarkable performance in the film is he does this performance called Moonskate, which I think is his masterpiece and was never filmed professionally, and it's just so moving, and it's about his position as a gay man in the world, the challenges that he was facing in the mid-80s, both professionally and personally. So we found this material, we found the Blue Danube, which becomes a big thing at the end, which allowed us to tell that. But I think actually we chose to try and make people watch John. And I think that was also a strong part of the film. I mean, I think that Afternoon of a Form plays for 3 or 4 minutes on a single shot. You know, that's very rare for a film. You know, Moonskate is 4 minutes on a single shot, you know, without cutting. But actually what I wanted to do was to recreate the experience of seeing John and actually not just cutting away or showing its highlights. And we tried shorter versions and we tried cutting away, and it was terribly ineffective, where it's actually the mesmeric state of as if you were there watching the white ghostly figure sliding on the darkened stage is powerful. And the way your brain reads and computes that, 10% of what you see, you're actually seeing 90% your brain's making it up and your eyes darting around. And films use that the opposite way to deceive you into feeling things. And I wanted to actually reverse that, and just as you might look at stand looking at a Monet or a Mona Lisa, and you see it more by looking. That's what I wanted you to see in the film.
And there's an interesting way, I guess, sport is filmed, and certainly was back then, in a different way than it is done now, with angles, with technology. As a filmmaker, you might want to shoot something in a different way. You've obviously got the source material, but there is something poetic and poignant about, I mean, I remember this from cricket matches, football matches, and Torvald and Dean, which was 84, I guess. Was it 84? Of the kind of poetry of some great sporting moments that, despite watching them on a fairly small, crappy analogue TV set, they have a poignancy driven through memory. Mm. How was that for you, watching this stuff back again and then having to make it into a film, having to add an extra layer of context to it? Did you just want to kind of almost play it on a TV set and say, well, that was how it was? Do you know what I mean? About the idea of framing this stuff that people are familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, the only point where that really played into us was really the Don Quixote routine, which was the Olympic routine. So we were relying on the Olympic coverage, but it was also his European and his world's routine, and where we had all the rehearsal footage from Colorado. So that allowed us, and in fact, actually, we planned it out. So there's different bits of the routine that come through. First of all, you see the rehearsal, and we did the music, so it's on the piano, so it's like it's in a rehearsal, and you see him doing it and you're not quite sure what it is, and then you see the next performance where he wins the Europeans or whatever, and it's a good performance, but we don't show it in its full majesty. And then we get to the Olympics, and then we're like, okay, we're gonna show this. And we had the advantage of being able to go to like three or four sources. And the classic thing, of course, with live broadcast is that different feeds are sent to different countries. Mm. So we went to different countries and tried to find different angles, but not to zhuzh it up in the way that we would might do in a cricket. I think, you know, I made films about cricket, you know, particularly where you want to be able to tighten up the action. Actually, this was about, because it's defined by the pace of the music already. You can't change the step. The one thing I wasn't going to do was use the wrong bit of music against the wrong bit of choreography. You know, I hope I haven't done that. We're going to say, and actually that was a big challenge, because actually we then had to then go and bring a composer in, because often Curry used a live orchestra, and the recording of that orchestra would have been to the TV sound, so it wasn't that good for a cinema audience today. So then we had to like get a composer in and rearrange that music, and then we went to Bratislava and had a full 60-piece orchestra to recreate the music to the correct tempo as it would have been at the day.
That's interesting, because that was kind of what my question was about, is that idea of there is something poignant about the roughness of the original. But yeah. you've changed the music,
you see. That was what we did. And actually, we stripped away the sound. And obviously, we used, we arranged it exactly as it was, you know, and we used this orchestra so that the sound feels very big. And then we obviously had to foley all the ice, foley is when you make the matching sound, the ice skates, and then put the atmospheres in. So we had to rebuild this atmosphere to make it feel, to somehow make the cinema feel like the theatrical experience that it would have been at the time. And that was sort of key, really, I think, you know.
I just wondered, in terms of your perspective of Curry the man, and we started by talking about the complexities of his character and the pressures that were on him through his whole life, really. Do you think of him more as an artist or an athlete now? And is that even an important distinction to make?
I think it is an important distinction to make, because I think it's right to think of people the way that they would want to perceive themselves when they've achieved something extraordinary. And I think I came into it thinking Curry was an athlete and not really understanding that he was an artist. And what I would now say now is he's a very important artist in an art form that's slightly been lost, you know, partly because so many people died. But yeah, I mean, you know, and part of it was a bit of resurrecting just these amazing performances that do stand the test of time. You know, you can watch them and go, that's just extraordinary. Anybody can watch them, even if you hate ballet, skating, whatever. And so I think, yeah, absolutely, has to be seen as an artist, and that was what he wanted. You know, the gold medal was just a stepping stone to create a new place of the imagination. Imagine that. Imagine when Toulouse-Lautrec dies or whatever, there's like 100 other great painters, or 50 other great painters. There's no, like, there's no uniqueness about it, even though the painting may be unique, it sits within the canon. And to be the only great, the greatest ice skater, and to do something very different deserves recognition and remembrance that he achieved that goal. I mean, it wasn't just that he attempted it, he actually did it.
Thank you, James. And The Ice King is in cinemas across the UK now and be hitting global screens through 2018. You, of course, are tuned in to The Monocle Weekly. Episode 451, Tom. I really enjoyed today's show.
The Archie Blowers. Yeah, fascinating stuff. Kind of a mix, but all inspiring in its own way, apart from Henry.
I did quite like his rehashing of Orwell's sort of prescriptions to the perfect pub, though. Kind of reminds you, doesn't it? To make sure you go and have a drink immediately after cutting this programme.
Yes, never before. Never before.
Never before. We'd never
do
that.
But it's funny. I don't know. There is something sort of, yeah, joyous about the kind of esoteric Englishness of that, which pleases me a great deal. But then it's funny, because we were talking to Josh about some of the features in Monocle magazine, of course, and we're actually going to visit on the printed page places that kind of, okay, they can't tick every box, but they've taken that somewhere, you know, interesting and relevant for today. So it's good to see.
Thank you also, of course, to Jeremy Gavron and to James Erskine. Fairly decent heavyweight bookings, aren't
really they? Interesting
from the world of the novel and the world of the documentary film. It's great stuff. Let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall and researched by James Kitchen. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. And The Monocle Week will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Bounds.
I'm Tom Edwards.
Thank you for tuning in.